Outside the dirt-caked garage, Rosalia followed the group of marching humans as they continued down the street toward the beach. Besides the six in hoods, four others followed, their movements less regular and more shambolic, almost as if they were sleepwalking. Trotting along at her side, belly on legs let out an excited yip, peering back over his shoulder.
Hush, stupid mutt!
Rosalia stepped into the shadows between the two nearest buildings, both of them ramshackle huts, showing the heavy trauma of weathering. Peering back to where the excited dog was looking, Rosalia saw another man pacing along the street, this one more upright, with an almost military gait.
Magistrate.
He had a shaved head, the start of a beard on his chin, and as he came closer, Rosalia saw that his right ear was mangled where it had suffered some kind of wound. As she watched him pass, Rosalia saw the man lift his hand to his ear as if in pain.
I can hear you, Domi. Quit blabbering in my fucking ear.
Domi? Rosalia knew that name. It was another of the Cerberus people, the one she had met with here just a few months before. Domi had been the curious-looking girl with the pure white skin. She had been a hellion, Rosalia recalled, savage in her manners and brutal in her fighting techniques. An outlander, uncivilized, despite her outward affectations. Which didn't explain who the man with the bullet-bitten ear was, although it did heavily imply that he was part of the Cerberus team. They all communicated using some kind of internal electronic device she knew, had seen it with her own eyes. Keeping her distance, Rosalia padded after the shaved-headed man, the pale-eyed mongrel at her side. At a lower level of the favela, Domi had decided to follow the alleyway she had found by the jaunty chicken keeper. She engaged her contact communicator once again, trying to raise Edwards, but the response was the same as before, which was to say there was no response.
Come on, Edwards!
Domi trotted past a crate of rotten fruit that three young children were busily picking through. The children wore no clothes, and they glared at Domi with feral eyes as she passed them. Ignoring them, Domi continued up the winding passageway between tumble-down dwellings.
Cerberus, this is Domi. I need a favor.
A moment later, the cool voice of Brewster Filboid, one of the mainstay operatives at the Cerberus Redoubt, came back over the subdermal relay.
I read you, Domi. What's going on?
I've lost Edwards. Do you think you could use his transponder to give me a fix on his location?
Doing so now.
Transponders were implanted beneath the skin of each member of the Cerberus team, broadcasting a telemetric signal that provided the Cerberus nerve center with a constant stream of information about an individual's health, including heart rate, blood pressure, and brainwave activity. At a keystroke, these blips could be expanded to give full diagnostics for each member of a field team. With satellite triangulation, the transponders could also be used to track down an individual to within almost a hairbreadth of their actual physical location.
So, how did you lose him anyway?
He went out for some fresh air and, gave us the slip.
Gave you the... I didn't realize Edwards was a prisoner.
He's not, which is why his disappearing like this is all the more worrying.
Okay. Right. I've got Edwards tagged now. He's westbound, heading in roughly the direction of the ocean. By my reckoning, you're about 3/4 of a mile from his current location.
Which way?
You're heading north just now. You want to turn left as soon as you can and keep roughly to that course.
Okay.
Domi saw a gap between two of the broken-down huts. She rushed through the gap, ducking beneath a jutting strut of metal and weaving past a group of young mothers discussing something or other while they rocked their babies in their arms. The mothers peered at the ghostly, chalk-white figure of Domi as she darted past them.
I've just brought up the live satellite feed now, Domi. That place is nothing shy of a maze, and you are heading for a dead end.
Damn it! See if you can raise Edwards from your side while I find myself another route.
As she spoke, Domi reached the end of the current pathway, just as Filboid had warned. A high wall loomed before her, its brickwork covered in damp lichen of a putrescent green shade with tiny mauve buds. To her left stood a ramshackle collection of aluminum cladding and wooden crates, somehow balanced together to create a rainproof structure, give or take a leak, within which dwelled a family of seven. Above the dwelling, a tin can chimney contentedly chuffed billowing black smoke from the family's tiny cooking stove. To Domi's right, a similar building stood, its makeshift walls leaning at uncomfortable angles, apparently propping itself up in spite of the desires of gravity. It was instinct, nothing more than that, but Domi felt certain that Edwards was in trouble. Assessing the two dwellings, to either side of her, the albino woman reached up to the roof sill of the one to her left and sprang, her legs kicking out as she ran up the wall, pulling herself to the roof. From up there, just one story above the ground, she could see across the immediate area. There were numerous run-down shacks with smoking chimneys made from old piping or cans. The street plan, such as it was a labyrinthine mess of lefts and rights, abrupt stops in the roads where a new family of refugees from the destroyed villes had moved in and set up their home. But up here, on the rippled rooftop of corrugated iron, Domi could see a far easier way to travel through the run-down favela.
Domi? I've tried Edwards, but I'm having no success. A remote test shows his contact seems to be working, he just doesn't appear to be responding.
Domi strode across the rooftop, speeding up to a run as she reached its end.
What does the transponder show? Is he conscious?
Yeah. As she spoke, Domi leaped from the rooftop to that of the next building. From there, she kept running, moving with long strides of her bone-white legs, her pace quickening.
He's moving, but that's not a definite sign he's awake. Stand by, I'm bringing up a full bioscan now.
Domi ran, her feet pounding lightly against the hollow roofs as she rushed over the heads of Hope's Shantyville populace. A moment later, she had found a lower section of the moss-smeared wall, leaping over it in a single bound, her legs scissoring like a high jumper as she flung herself over the obstacle and headed west. On the other side, the petite albino woman found another rooftop, this one made of rain-damp wood. She ran onward, listening to Brewster's voice as she made her way toward the coast. Edwards was still trekking after the silent, hooded figures he had found himself drawn to while he was administering medicines to the locals. There was something about them, he knew, something eerily familiar. He just couldn't place it. The irritating pain in his head didn't help matters either.
Edwards, this is Cerberus. Please respond and state your position.
Hey, Brewmeister. I'm heading west, I think, following a group of suspects.
Edwards waited for Philboy to acknowledge, but nothing happened.
Suspects? Perps? Whatever you non-mags call them? People? Weirdos? You getting this?
Again, there was no reply. Irritably, Edwards continued along the road between rundown tenements, wondering why his home base wouldn't respond. After all, they had called on him, not vice versa.
Come on, Cerberus, answer the damn call.
Behind Edwards, stalking through the shadows, Rosalia followed the broad ex-mag, her pale-eyed dog loping along at her heels. Rosalia wasn't being particularly subtle, she knew, and yet the wide-shouldered man seemed oblivious to his tale, as though his mind was too caught up on other things. She hurried along the street, her booted feet splashing the puddles that littered the pockmarked road.
Okay, Magistrate Man. Let's see what you've got.
Domi leaped through the air, bouncing from rooftop to rooftop like some out-of-control jack-in-the-box as she rushed through the shanty dwellings that lay at the outskirts of the fishing bill.
Brew, you have that heads up on Edward's status yet?
Sorry about that, Domi. He's conscious, his transponder is showing live brain activity, and his heart is beating as normal. I just got a consult to double-check I was reading it right.
Bounding down from a two-story shack, Domi hit the ground running, weaving through a crowd of customers at a makeshift market stall as they bartered for the local produce. By the smell of it, the produce was already on the turn, but Domi had no time to consider that any further.
So he's alive, conscious, and his contact appears to be operational. Any ideas what's going down?
I'm bringing in satellite surveillance now. There's a crowd gathering out there, close to the coast. Keep on track and I'll guide you.
How far?
You'll be there shortly. Take the next right and head up toward the hills.
Domi took the next right as instructed. Whatever Edwards was involved in, he had better have a damn fine excuse for breaking contact. The hooded figures in the distance had stopped, amassing in a block of scrubland that overlooked the ocean. Edwards halted to watch them, and Rosalia also halted so that she could watch both him and the figures in the hoods. Other people seemed to be appearing from all around now, drawn to the hooded group as they waited. Some of them carried the pebbles that the people had dropped like calling cards all over the ville. Within a few minutes, the watching crowd had to have become 40 or 50 strong, waiting in near silence for whatever it was to proceed. Edwards made his way along the rearmost edge of the crowd, sticking to the shadows of an uneven wall, one eye on the hooded figures while he took in the faces here. They seemed to have been drawn here, called by something unseen, just as he had been. He reached for his face, rubbing at his forehead where that dull ache resided. Suddenly, one of the six figures began to speak.
Come one, come all! Everyone is welcome here. This is where all salvation starts. Shall we begin? We come among you today to bring you Utopia, a paradise that you cannot begin to imagine. But before we start, I must ask a question.
Edward stopped walking as he reached the edge of the wall that hid him, turning to face the speaker. The man reached his hands up and pulled back the low-hanging hood that had obscured his face. Around him, his five colleagues did likewise. Edwards narrowed his eyes, seeing something on each man's forehead, a circle no larger than a fingerprint.
Who here already bears the mark?
Several members of the crowd stepped forward, both men and women. They were the same people who had been following the group from down in the favela.
Come now, there are more of you, I'm sure. There's no need to be shy.
Almost against his will, Edwards found himself stepping forward, edging away from a dead tree he had found himself standing beside, stepping away from the shattered wall. He could feel himself being drawn to the speaker, feel the man's hypnotic call inside his head. A part of him wanted to join the group, and, worse, that part of him seemed to be making the decision for the rest of him. Edwards wasn't the only one. Others were emerging from the crowd, pushing their way to the front. Suddenly, a woman's voice spoke close by to Edwards' ear, just as he was about to make his way out from the wall and into the crowd.
Sorry, Cerberus, but you're cramping my style.
Edwards felt a heavy blow to his head then, and he collapsed to his knees before sprawling forward, a trickle of blood pouring down the side of his face from where the woman had struck him with a fallen branch from the tree. As Edwards' consciousness flickered and dimmed, the last thing he saw was the lithe, olive-skinned woman striding away, hiding herself among the crowd, her mongrel dog trotting along faithfully at her side. As Domi hurried up the mud steps toward the road that Philboyd was indicating over the contact link, the man's voice came to her again.
Domi, we may have a problem.
Go ahead, Cerberus.
Edwards' transponder just flatlined. He's either lost consciousness or...
Don't say it, Brewster. I'll be there soon enough.
As she hurried up the steep steps, Domi just hoped that wasn't as ambitious a statement as it sounded to her own ears right now. Roughly 12 miles beneath the surface of the Pacific, two Cerberus Manta craft glided gracefully through the water toward the cruciform structure that waited at the bottom of the sea. After their tangle with the giant squid-like creatures, both pilots remained alert and cautious of what was going on all around them, and the tension in the cockpits of both vehicles was acute. The whole approach was done using the heads-up sensor display and guided by an automated system that seemed to already know the position and entry route for the docking gateway that resided on one side of the immense coral-like cross.
Almost there now, Clem.
I feel like we just went 10 rounds with the Kraken of legend.
Grant guided the Manta along the final approach. He could see from the sensor display that Kane was following in his own craft, and there were no more sea monsters out there, at least for now.
Bridget called them librarians.
The Kraken was a fearsome beast, a sea monster that was said to roam the oceans around Norway and Iceland. Modern interpretations suggest that the Kraken really was some kind of giant squid that generally made its home in the ocean depths.
Sounds like our librarian, all right.
You're completely unfazed. You, the three of you, do this kind of thing a lot, don't you?
Define a lot.
The Manta floated through a wide coral archway within the cruciform structure. A moment later, they found themselves dipping even lower as Grant followed the tunnel beyond the archway, keeping to a slow, steady pace as his sensor array began bringing up reams of new information.
I've entered some kind of tunnel construction.
I've got your back, buddy. Entering the structure now.
The tunnel continued to sink, dropping at a 30-degree angle as it burrowed beneath the ocean bed. Peering through the back window panes, Clem was delighted to see that the walls were visible, lit sporadically by some kind of phosphorescent moss that grew upon the walls in shades of pinks and orange-reds, the color of a peach's skin.
It looks like a magical grotto.
Up ahead of him, Grant peered past the heads-up display information, looking through the windshield at the otherworldly sight of the cavern that they were slowly traveling through. Clem was right. It really did look like something magical, like an illustration from a child's storybook. The tunnel's uneven walls seemed to twinkle with the strange lighting as the manta followed its mysterious path.
Do you realize that we are probably deeper beneath the ocean than any human has ever been?
Grant eased up a little on the thrust to the engines, letting the manta glide as the tunnel began to rise steeply once again. A moment later, they found themselves emerging from the water in what appeared to be a vast cavern filled with air, and once again lit by the strange glowing lichen that clung to the walls in its obscure patterns. The cavern featured a huge circular pool in its center from which the manta had emerged, with a border of flattened rock at its edges that led to an opening on the far side of the cave, its entryway approximately 6 feet across. To Grant's surprise, there were three manta craft already waiting at the edges of the pool, their blister-like cockpits drawn back and showing them to be unoccupied. Grant examined the opening at the far end of the cavern, allowing the sensors to judge its width.
Too small for us to fit through. Looks like this is where we get out and walk.
Excellent. I could do with stretching my legs.
Grant brought the manta around, edging it on vertical jets toward a spot against one rocky wall, away from the other docked mantas, before bringing it to rest in the water. The water here was shallower, and Grant felt the bottom of the manta's hull plunk lightly against a shelf that was hidden just a few feet beneath the water's surface. The shelf was at the perfect height to allow the manta's wings to rest level with the rock circle that bordered the room, as if it had been designed as a kind of docking bay for these ancient craft of Anunnaki design. As Grant eased the manta to a resting position, Kane's vehicle emerged from the circular pool, water streaming off its sleek lines as the red-orange light glistened off its mirror-bronzed surface.
Docking bay.
So I see.
Inside his own manta craft, hovering just a few feet above the surface of the water, Kane allowed the sensitive scanning equipment to analyze the cavern and what it could see beyond its walls.
I'm picking up a nebulous reading of a lot of life forms, but the details seem unclear.
It looks like a coral reef, a living habitat. We're likely to find a lot of things making their homes here.
Then, following Grant's lead, Kane brought his manta down on the hidden shelf that surrounded the rim of the pool, taking one last look at the area through the complex scanning equipment aboard his craft. Once he had landed, Kane removed his helmet and opened the cockpit seal. Then he and Bridget made their way down one sloped wing of the craft and out onto the rocky border that circled the room. Already disembarked, Grant and Clem waited by the wing of their own craft while their colleagues made their way over to join them. Grant was checking the damage his vehicle had taken in the meeting with the colossal librarians, relieved to see just a few dents and scrapes. They'd been lucky. Grant wore his favored Kevlar trench coat over his shadow suit, while Clem had added a padded jacket over his Cerberus jumpsuit, and he pulled the wing of the collar tight to his neck, staving off the cold of the cavern. In fact, despite being roughly 12 miles beneath the surface of the sea, the temperature in the grotto was surprisingly mild, just a little cooler than normal room temperature. Additionally, there was no breeze in the area at all, which seemed slightly peculiar for some unidentifiable reason. The mantas had been designed as spacefaring craft, and their sensors had automatically informed their pilots that they were re-entering a breathable atmosphere before opening the cockpit seals.
At least we can breathe.
Guess the lizards didn't like getting wet.
Grant had never been comfortable discussing the intricacies of Anunnaki society or technology. As Bridget joined them, Grant acknowledged her with a grim nod.
Hell of a slick move back there.
The Titian-haired woman acknowledged his thanks with a self-conscious smile before indicating the three abandoned craft within the cavern.
Someone else on the guest list?
If there is, they arrived a long time before we did. There are barnacles on the bottoms of the hull, see?
The other Cerberus warriors followed Clem's eyeline, seeing the lumpy growths along the waterline of the sleek craft. The bronze metal had turned to green in ugly patches, too, and on closer examination, each craft appeared to be in a state of disrepair.
Guess they've been here a while.
Well, their pilots are probably long since dead, then.
Could have been dead 10,000 years or more.
Grant brought his Copperhead assault subgun out of a hidden recess in his coat and scanned the cavern with its sole above-water entry point warily.
Still, I'd rather we keep our eyes open just in case they're not.
Kane powered his own weapon, the Sin-Eater pistol, into his hand from its hidden wrist holster.
Anunnaki live for a long time. Keep behind me.
With that, Kane led the way into the entryway tunnel that led from the docking pool. Warily, the Cerberus field team made its way from the area that they had deemed the docking bay and into a corridor that stretched off into the main area of the undersea complex. The corridor was quite narrow, too tight for all four to walk abreast, and so Kane took the lead, his Sin-Eater handgun clutched ready in his right hand. Though tight, the sides of the corridor stretched quite high, towering to almost 14 feet above them, and narrowing to an arch-like point that ran along its center. It was low-lit, small pods glowing in eerie blue amid the structure of the walls themselves, and the light was too erratically spaced and too dim to cast firm shadows, instead rendering everything into a vague, foggy sort of blandness. Close up, the walls and floors seemed to be made of dried coral, and Kane was struck by its uncomfortable similarity to bone.
Feels a little like an ossuary. Smells like one, too.
Grant clutched his Copperhead assault rifle, a fiercely powerful weapon and one of his favorites when in the field, purely because of its ease of use and the sheer level of rapid destruction it could bring. The grip and trigger of the gun were placed in front of the breech in the bullpup design, allowing the weapon to be used single-handed, and an optical image-intensified scope coupled with a laser auto-targeter were mounted on top of the frame. The Copperhead possessed a 700-round-per-minute rate of fire and was equipped with an extended magazine holding 35 4.85-millimeter steel-jacketed rounds. Beside the Copperhead subgun, Grant also wore his own Sin-Eater pistol and a responsive wrist holster like Kane's, where it could be called to his hand with the speed of thought. Striding between the two X-Mags, Bridget and Clem kept their wits about them, but showed more interest in the nature of the corridor itself. Clem especially was fascinated by the suggestion of sea life that he saw here.
An ossuary might not be so far from the truth. I rather suspect that the foundation for this structure could, in fact, be a skeleton.
It'd be one hell of a big skeleton, Clem.
Those things we saw outside, the librarians, were creatures of exceptional magnitude.
If it is a skeleton, and it died a long, long time ago, the coral that's grown up here looks to be several feet thick.
Things die all the time, Bridget.
As they continued to make their way down the corridor, Grant spotted something from the corner of his eye. He turned, automatically bringing the Copperhead subgun around to track whatever it was that had drawn his attention.
Everything okay, partner?
Kane halted in his own progress. His own senses were on high alert, and something nagged at the edge of Kane's consciousness. It felt as if he was being watched. Grant stood stock still for a moment, his eyes narrowed as he examined the wall before him in the dim light. Its bumps and ridges were like valleys, a miniature landscape full of peaks and caves. 3 feet away from where he had stopped, one of the blue lights flickered a little, and then, utterly soundless, it winked out.
Grant?
Fine.
The others began making their way along the narrow corridor, but even as Grant turned, there came a sound like needles dropping into glass from very close to his left ear. Grant turned, but it was almost too late to see the thing in the semi-darkness. Something skittered across the surface of the coral, something no bigger than Grant's fist, and with an abundance of long, whirring legs that propelled it along at incredible speed.
Whoa!
His companions turned at their friend's outburst and saw him jump sideways until he met with the wall on the other side of the narrow corridor. Grant spun then, looking left and right at the wall he had automatically propelled himself against.
There's something alive here.
Kane raised his Sin-Eater before him as he trotted back down the tight corridor to meet with Grant. Bridget Baptiste gave Clem a reassuring look as she pulled a TP-9 from the holster she wore slung low to her hip.
Stay behind us, Clem. You'll be safe.
Clem nodded agreement, keeping his distance as he followed Bridget's slender form retreating down the corridor.
What did you see?
As he spoke, another of the dull blue lights winked out behind them, casting the corridor into ever-deepening gloom.
I only saw it for a second, but it looked like some kind of spider. Lots of legs, and it moved real fast.
How big?
There was another movement as something leaped from the craggy surface of the wall.
Shit!
Whatever it was, it had jumped the gap between the wall and Kane, and the ex-mag spun as he felt it land upon his back.
What the...
Without stopping to think, Grant swung the copperhead around, jabbing with its butt at the skittering creature that was scrambling over Kane's shoulder. The creature dropped to the floor. Grant and Kane watched, disgusted, as the hand-sized creature disappeared into a nook in an uneven coral surface of the floor, its long, spindly legs disappearing from sight.
What was it?
I don't know. We're thinking spider, maybe.
Where did it go?
A little bugaboo found a hole or crevice or something, just about there.
Clem crouched down on his haunches, his dark eyes furiously scanning the lumpy ground.
You want to be careful there, Clem.
This could be a new form of life. It's our duty to catalog it.
You must be mistaking us with someone else, Brian. We go in, we get the job done, and then we get the fuck out of here. Right now, I'm really looking forward to getting to point C in that list. You read me?
The mission comes first, but it does rather go against my ethos.
Well, it wasn't your ethos that got crawled on now, was it?
Clem was about to respond when the spider-like creature reappeared from a gap in the floor, and Grant shoved him to one side as he swung the copperhead assault weapon to bear.
Grant, no!
Clem's instruction, or perhaps it had been a warning, came too late. Grant unleashed a blast from the copperhead, and a smattering of lethal 4.85mm bullets peppered the ground about their feet, their explosion bright in the semi-darkness of the corridor. The weird creature was instantaneously reduced to a messy pulp as one of Grant's bullets drilled through its hard carapace. It lay there in a pool of its own fluids, a milky, colored ooze leaking from the remains of its body as its legs twitched. Although it had been mashed up by Grant's bullet, enough of it remained that the Cerberus warriors could define its basic anatomy. It was roughly 7 inches across, both length and width, in an almost perfectly circular form. The body itself was a dangling 2-inch oval amid the spray of long, needle-thin legs, and milky ooze seeped from a ruined area at its back left edge as the legs finally stilled. There were 8 legs in all, a neutral color like the body, the color of frosted glass. It made no noise, just continued to bubble in place as its white lifeblood seeped away into the uneven floor of the corridor, washing away in thin runnels as the liquid sought the path of least resistance.
You were right. It does look like a spider. Could be a crab of some sort. What do you think, Clem?
Whatever it is, I think we're about to get better acquainted, Miss Baptiste.
Bridget turned, as did Kane and Grant, automatically bringing their blasters to bear on the place Clem indicated. Up there, skittering along the walls and high arch of the roof, more of the glass-colored creatures were moving, their numbers lost to the darkness of the corridor. In the half-hearted blue light from the walls, it looked like 100 needle-thin fingers reaching out from the walls at Grant, pointing at him in accusation.
Clem, best guess here. Are these things likely to be deadly?
The ocean is full of numerous things that can be poisonous and often fatal to human beings. I'd suggest we don't touch their blood until we know what's in it.
As 100 spider-like creatures skittered across the walls, moving in a radial pattern toward the Cerberus heroes, Kane became aware of more movements at his sides, behind, and all around him. He glanced briefly to the side and saw more of the spiny creatures emerging from crevices in the coral wall, their spindly legs reaching out as they clambered into view, even as another of the dull blue wall lights winked out. As Kane turned back to the mass of creatures at his rear, yet another of the ocean blue lights blinked out, plunging another chunk of the corridor into darkness in the direction of the docking bay.
Let's keep going. Baptiste, you're on point.
Bridget grabbed Clem by the elbow and hurried him down the corridor in the direction they had been going before Grant had stopped. 3 steps later, and another of the ineffective blue lights fizzled out, leaving an increasing length of the corridor ahead of them in darkness, as was the whole of the tunnel length behind them. Clem slowed his pace, but Bridget urged him on.
Come on, Clem. Let's keep moving.
I don't relish walking into a situation blind.
Even as Clem said it, bright beams of light appeared from behind him. First one, then two, as Grant and Kane flipped on their xenon beam flashlights. Suddenly, the whole of the narrow corridor was bathed in brilliance, the xenon beams the equivalent of 5,000 candles of power. It wasn't an improvement. The bumpy, misshapen walls appeared to be alive with movement, the glistening, spider-like creatures skittering across their surfaces as they reared away from the bright lights. On the floor, too, dozens of multi-legged creatures scurried for cover, clambering over the uneven floor as they vied for space. As Bridget watched, more of the creatures emerged, their pencil-thin legs wrapping around the edges of the floor as they reared up, peering at the intruders.
Kane?
I see them, Baptiste. Let's hope that if we just ignore them...
Kane didn't get the chance to finish his sentence. One of the spider-like monstrosities disengaged from the wall before him and flew at his face. Propelled through the air by a powerful leap, its spindly legs waving before it like a snapping claw. Kane ducked, but as he did so, things took a further turn for the worse. The leaping creature seemed to throw something at Kane, either spit or secreted through some other orifice, and a thin spurt of yellow-white liquid dashed through the air, whizzing just over his head. To one side, Grant followed the little creature with the nose of his blaster as it dropped to the floor just behind Kane, its leap propelling it past its target. Without hesitation, he blasted off another round from the Copperhead close assault weapon, reducing the fast-moving creature to a messy pool of goo and quivering legs. Having avoided the thing's attack, Kane's eyes widened as he watched the pool of spit it had tossed at him. The venom, or whatever it was fizzing, bubbles appearing across its surface as it spewed a misty white trail of smoke like caustic soda where it had pooled on the uneven floor.
We may be in trouble.
The Cerberus warriors were absolutely surrounded by the monstrous creatures whose needle-like legs clicked as they raced across the hard surface of the coral structure. At the front of the group, Clem took a step back, even as three more of the multi-limbed creatures spewed streams of venom at him and Bridget. The venom streams rushed past them, creating smoldering trails on the ridged floor. Bridget took aim with the TP-9, blasting off three shots in swift succession, destroying the attacking creatures where they clung to the walls. It was hopeless, she knew. The odds were simply too great. Like some mythological beast, kill one and a dozen more rushed to take its place.
Kane, we need a better solution and we need it quick!
Then Bridget shoved Clem to one side as one of the wall crawlers leaped, its sharp legs poised ahead like blades. The creature sailed past where Clem had stood a second before, landing on the ground with a clack-clack of its legs and scurrying down the corridor toward where Grant waited with Kane.
Stay away, Clem. We're in a danger zone here.
More of the creatures were dropping from the ceiling and walls, a whole cloud of them leaping through the air toward Grant and Kane. Grant's Copperhead assault gun boomed in the narrow corridor, its loud blast muffled by the ridges of the tight walls. Several of the tiny monsters were caught in the blast, fizzling into fiery nothingness as Grant's bullets drilled through their fragile forms. Then they were upon him, six tiny bodies clambering over his chest and up his right arm, their needle-sharp legs pressing against his Kevlar coat and shadow suit. Moving swiftly, Grant swept the creatures off his arm, and two of them went flying through the air, while a third dug its spiny legs into his brushing hand.
Ah!
Grant yelped in pain as the needle-like legs prodded at his skin before swatting the thing against the nearest wall. It moved fast, trying to get away from its promised fate, but Grant's lightning-quick reactions trapped enough of the creature against the wall to flatten its bulk. Two more of the strange arachnids were racing across his chest, and one loomed over his breastbone, raising its carapace on those awful stick-like legs before spitting a gob of milky venom at the exposed skin of his face. Grant closed his eyes, turning his head as the acidic spew sprayed past him, smelling something like gasoline. He heard the fizzing of the liquid spray as it whooshed past his ear. And then something slapped against Grant's chest. He opened his eyes to see Kane flinging the remaining creatures from him, using the muzzle of his sin-eater. Kane flipped them into the air with a swift movement, blasting a flaring shot into one of them as it whizzed through the air, while the other bumped against and clung onto the wall, scuttling up the ridges before disappearing into one of the shadowy crevices there. More of the spindly-legged creatures were scampering across the floor and walls, their sharp talons skittering against the hard coral with a sound like raindrops on a tin plate. At the head of the group, Bridget was rapidly selecting her targets and drilling them with 9mm bullets from her TP-9, missing about one in three thanks to the creature's rapid movements. Suddenly, one of the monstrous things was on her foot, clambering to gain purchase on her leg, and Bridget kicked out, flipping the thing away in a graceless whirl of clacking limbs. More of the creatures were dropping from above, and Clem danced on the spot as sprays of acid venom rained down all around him. Keen watched as one of the ugly, spindly creatures turned and spit a gob of venom at Clem's back. The gob fell just short, and Kane rattled off another blast from his Sin Eater, turning the little monster into a pool of dangling goo. Another of the creatures pounced off the floor at Bridget, using its multiple limbs like a spring to charge forward, embedding itself in her leg. She roared with surprise as much as pain before turning her pistol on it and blasting a bullet through its colorless body. Even as its body exploded, another of the spider-like creatures dropped from the ceiling, landing in Bridget's long hair and entangling itself there in a moment. Bridget was struck by a weird sense of déjà vu as she felt the thing scampering across her scalp. She sensed that she had been here before, done this very thing before. It was strange, and all the more so since Bridget Baptiste had an eidetic memory, and the vague sense of déjà vu was, to say the least, very unusual in her because her powers of recollection were so potent. She pushed the thought aside, blindly reaching into her hair and placing her fingers around one of the creature's limbs. In a second, she had tossed the thing to the floor, and she stamped on it as it struggled to right itself, crushing its body beneath the ball of her foot. Goop oozed out around her boot as the creature was turned to sludgy pulp. Bridget ignored it, turning back down the corridor and shouting for Kane.
We need a plan here, and quick!
I know.
Kane looked around, playing the bright xenon beam across the corridor that they were in until it hit Bridget in the face, and she blinked so hard it was almost like waking up. A moment later, the beam lit on the scuttling creatures as his mind raced. The more prominent of the hard-shelled creatures reared back as the light struck them, diving into nooks and ridges as he tried to examine them while their smaller brethren skittered away, keeping their distance.
Light. They don't like the light.
Stands to reason, living down here in the darkness for so long.
Grant brought the beam of his own xenon flashlight around, adding its intensity to Kane's.
Put them together and keep moving forward.
Kane peered back over his shoulder, saw the skittering bodies there as the spider-like creatures rushed across floor and walls toward them.
They're going to keep following us, and we can't light up the whole area.
You want to bring that light around here?
Heads up.
Kane tossed Bridget the flashlight. Grant blasted another shot from his copperhead as yet another of the spindly creatures dropped from the ceiling, plummeting down toward where Kane stood.
I'll cover you, but let's keep moving, huh?
No.
Kane reached into a utility pouch at the side of his belt with his free hand. In a moment, he had removed three ball-bearing-like spheres, flashbangs, part of the standard arsenal carried by all Cerberus field teams. The flashbangs were tiny devices that could be hidden in the palm of the hand and used on unsuspecting enemies. Each compact sphere contained a volatile chemical mixture along with a small amount of ignition fluid. When activated, the flashbang would do exactly what the name implied, flash and bang. Different mixtures were available to create other effects, such as masking smoke clouds and tear gas, but the basic premise remained the same for each, a relatively harmless defensive weapon that could be used to surprise an enemy so that one could disorient and overpower them. Right now, however, Kane would have to admit he hadn't expected that enemy to be some weird alien spider-crab hybrid when he had stocked up his arsenal for the day.
Everybody look away.
As his colleagues ran, sweeping the rugged sides of the corridor with the fierce beams of their flashlights, Kane tossed three flashbangs behind him, counting down in his head as they bounced off the hard-packed coral and rattled along the floor. Kane turned away before he reached the count of zero, waiting for the short flashbang timers to take effect. Then, with cataclysmic fury, the trio of flashbangs ignited, their cacophonous noise achingly loud in the confines of the narrow corridor, their bright lights illuminating the whole area like a savage lightning strike. Eyes closed against the brightness that shone all around, Kane sprinted down the corridor, trusting his instincts and spatial awareness as he chased after his rapidly retreating colleagues. Behind him, he knew the hideous arachnids had to be scuttling for cover, their world turned upside down by the dazzling blast of light. If they cried out, if they were capable of such, Cain could not hear them over the ringing in his ears from the explosion. Bullets whizzed all about Cain, blasting overhead and spraying the walls as Grant and Bridget picked off more of the creatures that were scuttling after their prey. As he ran, Cain felt something small land on his shoulder, claw-like appendages jabbing at the protective weave of his shadow suit. Opening his eyes to a narrow squint, Cain punched at the thing, knocking it from his body as it spit a thick stream of the yellow-white venom at his face. The spray splashed over his shoulder before looping over and over in the air as the spider thing was knocked away. The venom fizzed there against Cain's arm for a moment, and the X-Mag was remarkably grateful at that moment for the protective power of the shadow suit that he wore. His feet crashed against the rock-hard floor, and Cain felt things burst as he stepped on the bodies of more of the weird arachnids. An instant later, he was at the end of the corridor, dark shapes visible before him in his narrowed eyes, and a strong arm reached around him, pulling him to a halt. It was Grant.
You're okay, man.
Cain opened his eyes wider, seeing the splurge of yellow-white that dripped from his shoulder. When he peered up, he saw that they stood in a vast chamber, the high ceiling a series of opaque panes that showed the inky darkness of the open ocean beyond. Augmented by the more diffused effects of the xenon beams in the vast room, there was enough light that Cain could see the huge scale of the chamber they now found themselves in. It was at least 10 times the size of the grotto that they had docked within, its farthest reaches lost in a blue-green gloom.
Well, where are we?
I think we're here.
Bridget pointed to something in the center of the huge chamber. A vast structure towered up into the rafters, dominating the center of the room. Cain saw it in sections as Bridget played the beam of the flashlight over its surface. So huge was the construct. It looked like an enormous upturned funnel with 8 great roots dangling outward from its lowest section, reaching across the coral floor like the arms of an octopus. As Bridget ran the beam across the center of the strange construction, Cain saw a majestic figure sitting there. And for a moment, he thought that the still figure was simply a statue carved from stone. And then, as realization dawned, Cain's heart thudded against his ribcage in alarm.
Ulacumus.
In the scrubland overlooking the beach in the township of Hope, Rosalia watched the members of the crowd out of the corners of her eyes, observing their reactions to the speaker in the hooded robe. The crowd seemed excited, hanging on the speaker's every word as he spoke of salvation and saviors and all the other reams of nonsense spoken by every preacher Rosalia had ever seen. It was uncanny the way they listened with such intensity. The crowd itself was made up of men and women, old and young. There were even a few children who, despite their youthful years, paid increasing attention to the speaker as he fed them his line of bull. As she peered warily around, Rosalia began to spot a few faces she recognized. She noticed the group of street thugs from the altercation in the church hall the previous evening, when Cain and the others had employed their usual strong-arm magistrate tactics to overpower them. Their leader, or at least the one who had led the attack that she had witnessed, wore glasses now, perched on the end of his nose at a slightly askew angle. He seemed entranced by the speech, as did his colleagues. That was strange. It wasn't normal that young predators like these gang members would fall for this kind of spiel, unless they were here to steal from the congregation. Rosalia made to brush her dark hair from her face, taking a more careful look at the street thugs. They seemed to be utterly entranced, their expressions blank and soulless. That was the word that came to her. She had seen people without souls before, and it was not a thing she wished to revisit. An elderly man stood with them, an outlander type with a dirty, drink-stained coat and a grisly beard. Rosalia did not recognize him, but he seemed to be leading them now. Perhaps one of the thugs' fathers? Rosalia turned her attention back to the speaker for a moment as he continued espousing his mumbo-jumbo about heaven on earth, a savior from the stars, and some great god called Ulacumus. The name was new, admittedly, but the rest was depressingly familiar to Rosalia, who had grown up in a nunnery. At her feet, belly on legs, began to bark, looking at someone in the crowd. Rosalia hushed the dog, turning her attention to her right to try to see what it was that had disturbed the idiot mutt. There were three children there, three familiar children. They were the same ones who had been outside her garage home when she had been awakened, tossing stones in a dirt circle in some derivation of Jack's. They were normal neighborhood kids, maybe 5 or 6 years of age. She knew them from around, sometimes gave them scraps of food if she managed to scrabble up any extra that she could tell was only going to rot. Three normal 5 or 6 year olds, and yet they sat erect on the ground, saying nothing, listening to the speechmaker with rapt attention. It was uncanny. Then the person next to Rosalia jostled her, and she almost struck her in automatic reaction. She stopped short, looking at the elderly woman there. The gray-haired woman was passing her something. For a moment, Rosalia took it to be a communion wafer, for it was small and circular and a light tan color. But as she took it, she saw it was not a wafer. It was a tiny rock, nothing more than a pebble. The woman passed a handful of these to Rosalia, instructing her to take one and pass the others on.
If you have one already, don't be greedy. Let others share in the future.
Someone off to Rosalia's right shrieked, and the ears of Rosalia's mongrel dog suddenly pricked up. The dark-haired woman crouched, soothing the mutt as he became visibly agitated, wondering what was happening.
Shh, it's nothing. It's okay. These people just want to be friends.
As she spoke, Rosalia felt something digging into her right hand, and she opened her palm to see the stone she had held there was now burying itself, working through her skin like some burrowing insect. She gasped despite herself, reaching for the rock with her other hand and plucking at it with her nails, pulling it swiftly free. The hard stone rolled out of her fingers and across her hand as if it had a life of its own. Then it was moving down her hand toward her wrist, digging at the joint there.
Damn, get off me!
With her broad, sharpened thumbnail, Rosalia flicked the burrowing rock off her skin and watched as it skittered across the ground to land by the feet of the person in front of her.
Now we are few, but soon we shall be many. Spread the word of Ula Kumis and he shall come. He shall save us all.
Ula Kumis. Ula Kumis. Ula Kumis.
As the people around her joined the chorus, Rosalia looked at her arm, wondering if the weird burrowing rock had damaged her, if it had already infected her blood or something. Were all these people already, what was the word, hosts? Were they all carriers for this strange rock thing?
You, woman, what is your name?
Rosalia looked up from where she crouched at her dog's side, seeing the speaker and his team standing over her. The crowd had parted to give them space.
Who, me?
What is your name?
Rose.
It was close enough, a name she would answer to without thinking. The nuns had taught her that in situations dealing with the unknown, it was best to keep a little in reserve and to offer the truth only by slight degrees.
Are you a believer, Rose? A believer in Ula Kumis?
At her side, the mutt started to whine, shuffling away from the robed men, clearly uncomfortable in their presence. Rosalia grabbed the dog by the scruff of its neck, holding the animal still.
Are you a believer, Rose?
I would like to be one. I need convincing.
Heaven is coming. Utopia. And you, Rose, shall be a part of it. You shall be an apostle in the order of Ula Kumis. Hold her down.
Rosalia's keen eyes flashed, assessing the situation in an instant. Six men, that was all. Rosalia could take six men. She could challenge them and beat them in combat, even trained fighters, even ones who were armed. She smiled, reveling in the challenge, as the first two strode toward her, the crowd watching in fascination. From her position on the ground, Rosalia moved her leg in a swift sweep, judged to a height of just above her opponent's ankles, designed to knock them off their feet. But when the blow connected with the first, instead of knocking the man over, Rosalia's leg stopped as if it had hit something made of brick. She cried out in her surprise and leaped backward to escape the man's grasping hands. The crowd there pushed her back at the approaching group as belly on legs, barked this way and that, not knowing which way to turn, which enemy to berate. Less than 3 minutes later, the crowd had dissipated and the group had left, leaving no real indications that they had ever been there. And Rosalia and her dog? They were gone too, and so was the sound of her awful, strained screaming.